So PacMAR didn't have a local office then? They didn't have an office here in Alaska?
They had an office in gives a new meaning to home office. It was in the corporate secretary's home at his home address.
Are the domestic insurers required to have an office here?
Yes.
Required to have a home office here.
Required to have a home office here. Oh, I see the joke now. Okay.
It was their home office. I mean, you look at the corporate records and it says their home office was at this street address, and you go there and it's out. They had the minimum required corporate records there. And if you really want to go find out what happens to the company, go to Seattle. They had come to us and asked essentially permission to do that because it just was not economically feasible for them to continue operating their Alaska office as they had, partly due to the fact they'd lost so many of their top people and they couldn't replace them in Alaska. They have to go out and steal them from some other insurance company, and the prices just keep escalating because we just can't fight this war. But that was when we had a differential for premium tax purposes from a domestic and a foreign insurer. And they said, we give up our domestic tax preference, but we got to move. And we said, okay, if you give up the advantages of being a domestic, why don't you move your stuff there? So that was the quid pro quo. Now there is no difference between the admitted or the domestic and the foreign tax. So
I can rattle you off a list of the domestics if you like, and John can fill in the ones that I don't.
Oh, that's okay.
I count 11 property casualty, two of which I believe are inactive.
Okay.
We've got about 11 active domestic insurance. That's interesting.
Then we have one life company and one hospital medical service corporation.
You know, I gave you the two examinations. We have one other unique thing. There's actually two companies in receivership. Great American Insurance Company of Alaska is in receivership. They have no business and no assets, and that's a technical thing that we have to do in order to liquidate the company is put them in receivership, give notice, and then in 6 months we can liquidate the company as having plus or minus.
Are they contingent liabilities?
No. There was a parent company, Great American Insurance Company, and they bulked everything to the parent and then sold the charter to somebody who never put the money in it to make it an active insurance company. So
I got a couple questions here about PacMAR, as long as we're talking about it. When was the first time the division became aware or even heard a rumor there was some problems there?
November?
I was going to say
a year ago.
Like November 86. Mm-hmm. And then up till that time, had they submitted all the required financial and business statements? And
yes.
So it was when they didn't do it 1 year, and that's when it really triggered.
Okay. In November, the Washington company was under examination by the Washington Insurance Department, and they were looking at some substantial reinsurance agreements between the two. And they called us and said, you might want to send someone down here to look at this. We did. We were concerned. We were within, a month of year end when a new financial statement would be generated. Mm-hmm. We were asking substantial questions, and at that time we were preparing to get our exam together.
Mm-hmm.
But then when it came time for them to file the annual report, and they hadn't, that became an obvious, why haven't they? And the law says we will suspend any company that does not file their annual statement by that date. So we suspended them. Then, of course, they got upset about that and did their other thing. But upon bringing our examiners in there, they found that the problems were... There was a lot of cover-up, and if you look at it very superficially, it didn't look too bad. They had reinsurance, and everything was fine. But if you look at who the reinsurers were, and was it paid for, and it was reinsured over here, but you got it back over here through the back door, and we've subsequently found out that the Washington company was doing all of the record keeping for the Alaska company. The Alaska company had zero employees. All the claims were adjusted by the Washington company. All the underwriting was done by the Washington company. And they did all of our record keeping. They can't separate the two companies' records. We have policies that are issued under the Alaska company, but there's endorsements issued by the Washington company. And we may find that the Alaska policy was signed by an officer of the Washington company. It was not an officer of the Alaska company. That's why I refer to it as an incestuous relationship.
Yeah.
They did not make clear distinctions, even though they were two separate companies and no longer a parent subsidiary. And that's why we're having so much trouble with this. You could spend another $5 million and never be able to absolutely say that this is the case for this company as opposed to that company.
Well, what's the effect of this going to be on coverage here in Alaska, especially on workers' compensation?
Well, we do have a fail-safe in workman's compensation, and that's the Guarantee Association. If everything else goes bad, the claims will be picked up by the Guarantee Association.
Well,
which means
the,
all
what's
of the other companies.
What's the effect going to be on the Guarantee Association?
It's not going to be good. And they're already paying on Transit Casualty, Carriers Insurance Company, Ideal Mutual, Union Indemnity, Mission, probably one or two more. So, yeah.
I mean, the Guarantee Association is already picking up.
Those companies are insolvent, unable to pay their claims, and the Guarantee Association are paying the claims for those companies, yes.
Is that one of the reasons the projected rate increase is going to be so high?
No.
That's a very minor piece of it. One of the tax elements in the rate increase, I think, is something like 0.7% accounts for that additional assessment. So there is a piece in there.
For the Guarantee Association?
Yes, sir.
And they have a maximum assessment in any one year of 2-2.5% of the premium, so you know, there is some limitation. But as respects the policyholder and the claimant, the claim will be paid. It may take a little more administrative work, and it may be a little slight delay.
Mm-hmm.
But it all comes back to you eventually, but the injured worker is going to get his check. As respects the Marine, that's a little different. There is no guarantee fund for the Marine.
So the capital and the surplus money should go to the Guarantee Association then? I mean, there's some, where is the money?
Okay, first of all, assuming that there's a liquidation, you take all the assets and there are certain priorities set out. And certainly the claims are a high priority. The cost of the administration of the receivership is number one. The claims are number two. And the owner of the company and the landlords and the telephone company are way down there on the priorities. So. Hypothetical, we have $10 million in outstanding claims, we have $5 million in cash. You distribute. The Guarantee Association will pick up the workman's comp claims, and they will in turn be a claimant against the $5 million.
Oh, okay.
And each individual boat owner that has a claim will be a claimant against the $5 million. And you may pay 50 cents on the dollar or 10 cents on the dollar, whatever. So the Guarantee Association pays 100% on the dollar, and then they will collect what they can out of the dissolution, bankruptcy.
Okay.
Fairly simple. We're not to that point yet, though. We have a substantial amount of money that we went down to California and Washington and grabbed and brought back to Alaska because it's a lot harder to get it away from our hot little hands if it's here than if we hold it in a California bank. If the California receiver wants it, you know, he can go and
yeah, as to that, was there some proposal that we were going to send that money back down outside, or is that money going to stay here?
Well, first of all, it's here. And we're using it for paying claims and administrative expenses. We have put out essentially an RFP for investment purposes. And we have sent it to Alaska banks, Alaska Savings and Loan, Alaska stock brokerages, Alaska insurance agencies that deal with insurance companies who may want to invest it, with the idea that we would like to, assuming that there's an advantage, if people in Alaska want the money, now we may find that the last thing they need is another $2 million on deposit because they don't have anything to do with it. But assuming that they want it, they can put in a proposal on what they would charge to manage it and what they would do with it, and it would have to be secured. And that we're starting to get those proposals in now. Interestingly enough, the few that I've looked at are basically, give us the money, we'll take 5% of the interest, and we'll go out of state and invest it for you. So that's what the Alaska banks are proposing to us, is that they take their piece and they go invest it in CDs from banks in Maryland or something.
What have we learned from PACMAR? I mean, is there anything the division is going to do differently from this experience?
I'm not sure we did anything basically wrong. You know, when someone is out to perpetrate and cover up, you know, we're not talking about a routine situation. When we had a reason to believe that something was happening, we did jump in expeditiously and grab them by the tail. Washington had been examining the Washington company for about 9 months. They got their order of receivership the day before we got ours, but we had to go to court on ours. Based on our presenting our case in court on the Alaska company, the board of directors of the Washington company held a meeting and said, we will voluntarily let the Washington company put us in receivership. So we did all the work. We forced their hand in Washington. So they've been examining for 9 months, and their company is a lot worse than our company, and they hadn't done anything. So we jumped in fast, prompt, got the good guys in there, got the hard evidence, went to court, and got the thing wrapped. So I don't know that there's a lot that could have been done differently. I suppose we could have gone in a year earlier and examined and spent $80,000 and uncovered this.
I think there is one additional thing that we do as a result of this. We look a lot harder at offshore reinsurance.
Yes.
You didn't go to the meeting that was held in Juneau with PACMAR, was it Stephen Schroeder?
He's the corporate secretary.
Secretary? And they requested a meeting with the division. And at the meeting, they were represented by their lobbyists.
At the meeting were Mr. Bell, the owner of the company, Stephen Schroeder, the secretary of the company, Dankworth, and Reinwand. And
I mean, it seems a little strange
there.
To me. I mean, I can see bringing your lawyers, but why would you bring your lobbyists?
You'd have to ask them. The lobbyists have told me that they were there to see what was going on. You ask them.
At that meeting, there was a discussion of the $3 million that was brought back to Alaska.
Yes. Yes. Now, I have to tell you something, that prior to that meeting, we had been told by the Attorney General's office that we had to reinstate that certificate because we took it because they hadn't filed their annual statement. Now, we think the AG's office was wrong on that, by the way, but when your attorney tells you that you've got to give it back, you can, I guess, go fight your attorney or you can cave. And we said, wait a minute, we don't think that's right, but what can we get? So without telling PACMAR that we were going to give it back to them anyway, we said the only way you're going to get that back is if you bring some money up here and show a good faith and something we can, you know, really grab onto. And they brought $3 million. So, you know, given the situation, we turned nothing into $3 million. And then we immediately said we're scheduling an examination, went in, spent a short period of time, and then took them again. We were not real happy with that, and I'm not an attorney, and maybe they were right. My gut reaction is that they were not right, and that we could have.
Is there a formal Attorney General's opinion that was issued on that? Something in writing on that?
There may have been a memo. It was not a formal opinion. But
could we get a
discussion?
Could we get a copy of the memo? Could the committee here get a copy of the memo?
Are you mumbling in the audience? Somebody has one?
It is a matter of public record. I don't know what that means.
Okay.
Okay.
We can get that?
You got it now? Okay.
Well,
one more thing,
okay.
on my list of agenda.
All
we
right.
brought with us a book that we now keep. These are the transmittal letters on rate filings that have been questioned or disapproved since January 1?
Since January 1. We also have it for two other years. That's the most current.
Now,
good.
You know, I mean, we've been accused of rolling over and whatever anybody wants, we grant it. These are the ones that are questioned or denied.
I'd like to take that back with me.
How
many have been denied?
Count them, Doc.
We didn't do a count. I just had my staff prepare this, and when I found it wasn't quite current, I asked to make sure it was current. This was delivered to me yesterday before plane time, so I haven't had a chance to really look through it. It's in here by month, and I can leave it here so you can get it over for the next couple of days. We would like to get this back.
Okay.
Now, part of our strategy is never to slam anybody's fingers in the door because they don't ever want to come back and test the door again.
Right.
So when we get something we just flat can't accept, we go back and say, we really can't agree with it that way, but why don't you come back to us with a different approach, or we would consider 5%, but we, you know, 50% is out of the question, but, you know, or have you considered that this may not be correct because of, and so we try and keep a dialogue, and sometimes they come back and say, yeah, okay, we'll go your way. Sometimes they say, no way, and we say, well, okay, but would you try some other way? Sometimes they finally come up with something that's acceptable, but at least they go away with the feeling that we tried to work with them to get something that was acceptable to them, but was acceptable to us and the Alaska consumers. And at least the next time they come in, they say, well, you know, we'll try it, rather than just those guys, you know, can't work with them, we're never going to do it again. So a lot of that, you know, is where we go back to somebody, something that was outrageous, and we go back and we say, no, not quite, but keep working. And you know, but I think given that that's a 6-month, or well, now it's longer than that, 9-month record, that's a lot of individual filings, and that means every one of those was looked at very carefully and torn apart and just couldn't go with it. And of course, there's a lot that we did approve. So.
I don't know if it made it in. Do we know whether the intent language regarding the pre-filing approval?
It is in the conference committee.
It's in the conference committee budget, okay. Are you going to have something for us next session then, like a proposal for that?
Well, I guess the real question is that not a case now? And all rates are required to be filed.
Right.
And I guess what we're really talking about is the nuance of going through on a deemer as opposed to something that physically says approved on it.
Right. Well, the way it is now, the law as I understand it now is if you don't take any action, they go into effect.
Correct. In a period of time. That's
right. So even if you didn't get a chance to even look at it, if you were swamped with them, they would automatically go into effect.
Every filing gets looked at, every filing gets dated and initialed by the person who looked at it and reviewed it.
Yeah, but what if you didn't have time to get to it?
Then we have the authority to send them a letter that says we're delaying our review period, or extending our review period on this.
And do you in fact do that for all cases?
We've not found it necessary. There have been occasions where we've done that. Also, if we question the filing, that automatically extends it until we have the appropriate answers.
Okay, well my question here, Don, is
we do look at the
is that your policy that if you don't have time to look at them, you automatically send that letter saying it doesn't go into effect until we have time to look at it? Has anyone have they ever had one just go into effect without you getting around to it?
I think I had a couple like that on title. That was my fault, and we have since fixed that.
It's almost like the governor deciding whether to sign a bill or let it take effect without his signature. And you say, well, has the governor ever had one of these bills become effective due to the time and he didn't know it? Well, I suppose there may have been a case, but certainly not the policy to let these things just slide through. But sometimes you say, okay, we'll accept it, but we're not going to sign it, or it's fine, and we would approve it, but for the fact we have to write them a letter, and we'll just let it go, and we don't have to write the letter. The time that we would have spent writing the letter, we can take looking at this filing that we really want to look at and do it. So
I think it might be helpful if I explain how the process is when those things come in. When we receive a filing, we date them in right then and there, and they're always in duplicate with a return envelope. A copy goes back to the insurer so they know when their statutory time starts running, and it's got a date stamp on it. The analyst then receives the filing and reviews it. And frankly, he'll receive a stack of them, and he'll go down through and look for those that need extra attention. Separate pile, goes back through the ones that require a little attention and sees if in fact they need any further review. And some of those are just going to go right through, but they've been looked at, they've been read. You then go back and do an in-depth analysis on anything that's left. And it's been our experience that all of that can be done in the required time frame. I don't deny it would be nice to have a longer time frame, but so far we've been able to live within that time frame. And everything does get looked at. I will tell you, not everything gets the super fine tooth comb, because once you read it, you say, hey, this is standard, or they're just refiling a copy of a declaration page that's been filed 1,000 times before, and it's the same. And generally the filing will tell us that. But they all get looked at. They all get initialed, and they all get read.
There's two other factors that I think have been maybe confused with rate approvals. Company A has a rate filing and it says the rate is $100. They want to sell a policy to XYZ Plumbing, and XYZ Plumbing is a substandard risk. They said there's no way we're going to write it for our filed rate, but we will write it for three times the filed rate. There is a consent to rate form where the buyer signs off, I understand that this is in excess of the filed rate, and I'm willing to accept it. And Company A can issue a policy at a rate that is above the filed rate. We also have the surplus lines market that is not subject to rate filing. And you find a company, a consumer that was insured with Fireman's Fund and the rate was $100, the premium was $100. And now Fireman's Fund doesn't sell it anymore. They said, we just can't do it, we're losing it, we're not going to file a $300 rate, that's it. It falls into the surplus lines market, and they say, sure, for $800, we'll insure it. Well, did the guy get an 800% increase? You're right. Did we approve anything? No. Do we have the ability to approve it? No. Do we review the policy form or the premiums on surplus lines? The answer is absolutely not. We do not have the authority. And that is the market of last resort, and That's why we have to keep trying to force coverage back into the admitted market where we do control the policy form and the rates. But when people talk about 800% rate increases, we didn't necessarily approve them. The company may have a consent rate form, or it may have gone to a surplus lines market.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize that before.
And what do you do when the consumer comes in and says, I want to buy this at three times the filed rate?
Yeah.
The fact is, if the form is totally in order, we generally will put our stamp on it and say, okay, go ahead.
There's two more major areas I want to cover, and it's House Bill 46 and its impact on the industry and workers' compensation. Are you two available the rest of the day? Well, then we can put off the workers' compensation until this afternoon for sure. There's so much I want to ask you.
There's always tomorrow.
Are there people available that wanted to testify? Is there anybody wanted to give some testimony this time?
Sure.
Could you please come forward? Maybe we can take some public testimony and then we can come back and talk a little bit more before we take a break.
Here?
Yes, please. Could you state your name and who you represent for the record?
Can people back there here?
I'll speak loudly. Can you hear? My name is Peter Huyck, H-U-I-C-K-E, the owner and operator of Huyck General Agency at 508 West 6th Avenue in Anchorage. I am neither a retailer, I don't sell insurance, nor am I an insurance company. I'm a wholesaler, an intermediary in other sense. I have lots to object about HB 46, but I'll confine my comments to AS 2127-200, which says, premium payment made to a broker shall be considered received by the insurer, and then a bunch of little ifs after it follows. I'm not an insurer, but my problem is if the retail broker does not pay me, what happens? I'm not an insurance company. Has my insurance company been automatically paid, even though I haven't, even though they haven't?
Okay, I'm getting a little confused now.
Okay.
There's brokers and agents, and then you're somewhere in between them and the insurance company?
I'm an intermediary, a wholesaler. A number of insurance companies, instead of dealing directly with the retail agent or their own employee as in State Farm or Allstate, hire a wholesaler to distribute their product in a certain geographical area or for certain specialized types of insurance. So I'm an intermediary. I work for myself, neither for the agent nor for the company.
What do you call that?
Managing general agency.
Okay.
And what this law here is, it's completely dropped me through the cracks. In a number of cases.
Wait a second. I don't understand what you mean by that.
Well, if the broker either goes belly up or runs off with the money, and he's been paid by the insured, this statute says the company has been paid. I haven't been paid because he either went belly up or he ran off out of the country. Let's say the policy is for $100,000. Now, this law says the insurer has been paid if the broker got paid. The broker is the insured's representative. But I haven't been paid, neither has the company. So what does this law do to me? Sometimes with complicated types of insurance, you'll have two or three intermediaries between the original retail broker and the insurance company. None of them have been paid. This is what this law has done, has dropped us.
Well, wait. When you say now dropped, are you expressing concern that you may be liable for the claims your intermediary companies?
No, the premium. The premium.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I can help put his question into perspective.
Oh, you're saying you're concerned that you're liable for the premium to the insurer.
Yes.
Okay.
He is by contract liable to the insurer for any premiums that he has placed on their books. The people that come to him, the only people that can come to him are licensed brokers. And so the new section of law he's referring to, 2127-200, in section 17 of House Bill 46, says in determining an insurer's entitlement to coverage or return premium, a premium payment made to a broker shall be considered received by the insurer if the payment was at the time it was made designated for specific coverage and the insurer accepted or acknowledged coverage by issuing a policy binder or other contract for temporary insurance. That gets complicated when you've got an intermediary who's providing that. that route.
So you're that's saying that here the intermediary, not the insurance company, provides the binder?
Yeah, he's doing all the activity that an insurance company would otherwise do.
As an independent contractor.
The broker comes to him and says, hey, Peter, I need a policy for such and such. He goes to his insurance company, or he does on behalf of his insurance company that place, he agrees to place it. The broker collects a premium. When Peter has a problem is when that broker doesn't forward that premium to him. What the law says is that, what the new law says, is that since the insured paid the broker for that specific policy,
mm-hmm.
then the insurance company is responsible for the return. Peter's caught in the middle because he's responsible to the insurance company for anything the insurance company is liable for in terms
and
of
yet the return. I am not an insurance company.
Yeah, it sounds like you should get the money from the broker before you do that, or else you should...
Sir, that's impossible.
Or the insured company, the insurer should hold you harmless as their employee, basically their agent.
On the contrary, most insurers, when they deal with wholesalers, require the principal to sign a personal indemnity agreement. I give away the wife, the cat, the kids, the house, and everything else. Otherwise, I don't get the contract with the insurance company to be their wholesaler. I question whether maybe the legislature thought when they passed this wording that it's on the assumption that most brokers deal directly with the insurer. And maybe they weren't aware of the fact that there's in a large area of insurance industry, particularly in the surplus lines that we're talking about, there can be one, two, three, or four intermediaries in between the retail broker and the reinsurer. And again, as I say, all these people got dropped out of sight. Because if I don't collect from the broker, the law says the insurer has been paid. Well, even though I haven't been paid and I haven't paid the insurer says, well, look, Mr. Hike, you're going to turn around and honor this indemnity agreement, so you're going to pay us anyway.
Okay, now you said it was impossible to collect from the brokers before you issue the binders?
Is it impossible? And the general course of daily activity, sir, it is quite impossible... when the insured needs the insurance policy today because he is going to have that contract to work today, and yet he can only come up with enough money down payment to maybe arrange for a finance agreement. I'm supposed to say I will refuse to do business unless I get paid 100%. Is that what you're implying? And that man will not get the contract because he cannot get the insurance, and therefore you also won't get paid to buy the insurance.
The law states that only the premium actually paid is considered received by the insurance company, not some promise to pay.
Well, we normally deal on a 30-day account current. That means if we place we issue a policy effective October 1, we want to be paid for it sometime around November 1.
Mm-hmm.
This would be fine, but if the policy was for a $100,000 premium and the broker got paid for it,
See, and then left town. Yeah, see, that's the point. That's the issue right there. Did the broker receive the full payment? I mean, that's the only time that you'd be obligated or that the insurance company's obligated to consider itself as being in receipt. If the broker didn't receive payment, then the insured didn't pay for the coverage. Then the insurance company is not considered to have received the payment.
Let's say that $100,000 premium, the insured gave the broker 25% and arranged for a premium finance contract. Okay. So the premium finance company takes the 25% less the broker's commission and then issues a check to the broker for the 100% of the premium or 90% of the premium or whatever the retained down payment was.
Okay.
And then he gets that check and then leaves town. Now, the insured has only paid 25%. The finance company has paid 85, 90% or whatever the different... I don't know how they arrange all these things because I don't deal with the finance companies directly. And yet, theoretically, I've been paid or my company's been paid 100%.
Okay, I understand now.
I suppose I got to take responsibility for this because originally it was my idea, and Peter and I have talked at length and with others too. And we've had some real-world situations where a consumer goes into an insurance producer, buys insurance. Now, he doesn't know if the guy's an agent or a broker, but he pays his money, and he expects to have insurance, and then the next day the broker's or agent's doors close, and there's bankruptcy, and it is very material whether you paid your money to an agent or a broker. because the way the law was before, if you paid it to an agent, the company received it, period. But if you paid it to a broker, the broker is really the customer's agent, and therefore there is no coverage. Well, I mean, do you know, is your coverage placed by an agent or a broker?
Well, I...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's material as to whether you've got coverage today because the guy just went bankrupt and skipped with the money.
I think I know, but I'm not sure.
My point, I guess, in getting this is that Peter has a business relationship with the people that he deals with. And let's not make it Peter. Managing general agents have business agreements.
Okay.
They can check financial statements. They can get a bond. They can require certified checks. And those are all not great things for him to do, but he does at least have an out. What does the customer do? You know, I mean, he pays his money to the guy who was designated. Peter designates the broker to collect the premium on his behalf and send it to Peter, and the company designates Peter to collect it from the broker and send it to them. And you know, who's going to take the hit? Someone in this chain is going to take the hit. Is it going to be the consumer, the intermediary, or the company? And what we're saying is it ain't going to be the consumer. Because he paid in good faith. Now, if he knew this guy was going to steal the premium and paid it, I suppose that maybe you'd have an argument that, you know, there wasn't a good faith transaction. But we have seen people who are down to their last dollar. We got mandatory automobile insurance. They say, by God, the law says I've got to have it. They go in, they lay down their bucks to a broker. Their money disappears. They don't have insurance. They can't drive their car. They don't have the extra $400 to go do it again. And that's what we were trying to fix. And
I think you have to seriously look at renegotiating your contracts with the insurance companies based on
I might as well sell my business and go out of business. I mean, what this has done, let's translate it into something maybe more familiar to people. You have a house, you own it, you want to sell it, you put it on the market. I don't care whether you go to a real estate broker or not, you put it on the market. I want to buy that house. I choose to go through a real estate broker to buy the house. You want $200,000 for it. Let's say I'm crazy enough to want it for $200,000. I give my real estate broker the $200,000. He runs out of town. According to this law, as applied to real estate, I've bought the house. You never got your $200,000, but I bought it. Now, all I can say at this point is I have consulted with the attorney firm that I use locally. They have a constitutional law specialist. He's taken a not too deep look at the law. He says he would have no trouble challenging that on the basis of use a wrongful expropriation of property. That's where I will be if something can't be done, at least to relieve the exposure to the intermediary. Anything else?
No. Sirs, you were making a few comments in the back there. Did you want to come up and testify?
No.
Well, then...
I'll make a comment.
There is
Thank
a problem.
Thank you, sir.
A retail broker accepts money in trust. A producer accepts money in trust.
Well, wait a second. You have to identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm
record.
Charles Bedebeer. It's BeyteBiere.
Okay.
And I work for Preferred General Agency of Alaska.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, on this question, there is definitely a problem. I think we have put the solution in the wrong place. This has been my contention all along. Your retail broker that you buy your automobile insurance from accepts money from you in trust with the obligation to pay it to me or Peter Hike or to a company. Now, if he absconds with the money, there is a problem. But we are placing the responsibility for him absconding with the money on me. Now, as a surplus lines broker, I must file a $200,000 bond to do business in the state. If the state is concerned that the retail broker is going to abscond, let the retail broker post a similar bond. Let's put the responsibility on the shoulder of the man who is collecting the premium.
Yeah, Mr. Bedebeer,
mm-hmm.
The state's not putting the responsibility on you. The contract between the insurer and your class of providers, managing general agents, that puts the responsibility on you. Possibly the state would put some regulations that prevents the insurance companies from forcing you to have that responsibility
under
in your contract.
Under the definition of the brokerage of a broker, and if you will read the law, it states, we are not attempting to amend the definition of broker except as respects premium payments. So what we're saying is we are changing the legal definition of broker. And it is only this law that is placing that responsibility on me, because I have no agency agreement with that man who is writing the business.
Right.
The concept of law to this point, and until the passage of House Bill 46, has always been that you are a broker, I will do business with you, I have no agency relationship. Therefore, when I am paid, I am paid. If I am not paid, then I can cancel the policy for non-payment of premium.
Mm-hmm.
By the passage of House Bill 46, what you have done is you have said, well, you may think you're a broker, but we are superimposing an agency agreement upon you, and you are responsible for this man paying his debts. No one is responsible for me paying my debts. And I feel that the individual retail broker must accept the responsibility for the payment of his debts. I have to file a $200,000 bond, or I cannot do business in this state. We require a $10,000 bond from the retail agent. This doesn't make sense to me. I think what we are doing, I should bite my tongue. There has to be an enforcement and the checking of retail agents to see that they should be in business. And I think we are passing that responsibility on to the wholesaler and saying, we don't have to worry whether this man is doing business in a proper fashion or not, so long as we can make you responsible to pay his bills.
Yeah, I can assure you there was never any intent in the legislature, because we spent days and days and days working on this legislation to try to put the burden on the people between the agents and the insurance companies. The burden should be resting on the insurance companies, because they're authorizing you and those agents to act as their agents in that matter, and they should be the ones to take the risk.
That was
our intent all along.
If you were to have sincerely accomplished that, I will guarantee you, you will have a capacity problem and an insurance placement problem in the state of Alaska that you will not be able to solve, because the company simply will not do business on that basis. And what you have to stop and understand is, from a premium level, we do not impact, as a state of Alaska, any insurance company that heavily. Now, if you're talking to an insurance company...
We understand the concept.
All right, therein lies the problem. So if you want to keep the capacity, the only place that can fall, in the way the law is written, it's going to fall on me. I have several objections to 46, but we will confine it to that.
You talk about the bond, and I understand that some of my statements are not going to be really acceptable or even practical, but in a theoretical mode, you can require a bond of a broker that's dealing with you. They can put up a performance bond. You can, by contract with them, say, if you want me to accept business from you, you're going to let me come in and audit your books, and I'm going to make sure you have a trust account properly accounted for. Now, the fact that the division also has the ability to examine, and we've been short in that, but I will arm wrestle anybody that says that I have not been the leading proponent of tightening the trust account requirements and getting people to account and trying to prosecute people who don't properly account for the money and who do steal it and who do run off. And we have not been real successful, but nobody has tried harder than I have.
I will concede you that.
And so we have not accomplished everything we like, but we're working that way. But as an intermediary, you can choose who you do business with, and you can put whatever burden you want on them. Now, they're not going to meet it. I agree that that is a technical argument. But the fact is that if it comes down to, you've got that, can the consumer who walks off the street, can he enter such a contract with his broker? I suppose, before I let you write my automobile insurance agent or broker, I'm going to require that you put up a performance bond and enter into these... an examination of your record so that I'm confident that you're not going to steal my money. But frankly, you as an intermediary with multiple transactions with the same guy and the ability to cut off his livelihood are in a much better position to do it than the consumer. I think we have to operate as a team. You and I both got to go after that guy and make sure he's accounting for the money properly and that you do get it. I agree that the company bears some responsibility in this too. You can't just say, we don't like it, we're not going to do it. I think, indeed, if they have a problem, they need to come back to you and say, Bedivere, if we're going to do business with you as an MGA, and we're going to get stuck with these things, then by God, we want you to tighten up who you deal with. Frankly, I'm not sure you can deal with everybody. The practice is that anybody that comes in that's got a broker's license and wants to buy insurance from you, you'll sell it to them. And I'm not sure that's the proper mode.
Where is the responsibility of the individual insured in broker selection? Shifting to a totally different avenue. Many years ago, I ordered an item from a company. I paid them for it. This was not insurance. I didn't get it, and then I was notified they were in bankruptcy, and gee, that's too bad. Maybe I was negligent in not looking into the company I was doing business with. Now, this all comes, we get into a very wide myriad of subject here. You're talking about rate a moment ago. Now, is it really realistic for someone to say, gee, three companies want $1,000 for this, but Joe Blow down the street's going to sell it to me for $300? So I'm going to go give him my $300, and once I've paid it, whether he is honest, whether he is crooked, no matter what, I am totally protected by the law. I think there again the insured has some responsibility. But coming back to your statement, John, I was taught a long time ago, if something is good in theory but poor in practice, it's not good in theory. What you have here is a theory that, yes, I can go out and I can do all kinds of things to this individual broker. It would be simpler, and the net end result of what's going to happen is you are going to lose your surplus lines market.
Okay, I got confused with your example, your $3,000 versus the $300 example.
All right.
Wait, listen to my problem with the example. The law says that a binder had to be issued. Somebody had to agree to accept $300 as a premium before they issued the binder.
All right, poor example, Dave, but if someone is only looking to the lowest possible dollar, is that the only criteria that that insured has to can use? Throw the example out. The net end result will be, and I can guarantee this, that you will lose the surplus lines market. If I go to a broker and I say to him, you must give me a $100,000 performance bond, the problem is he will find somebody who does not require a $100,000 performance bond. Now, maybe down the road someplace that will save my life, because then that broker will abscond and I wouldn't have written the business and I won't be responsible for it. In the meantime, you have to keep yourselves in business. As to how many brokers might be able to come up independently with a $100,000 bond for every surplus lines broker they're going to do business with. John, we could be asking for a penalty of $1 million in order for the man to have enough availability of market. Now, the state requires $200,000 of the surplus lines broker. If I had to give a $200,000 bond to every company I did business with, forget it, I wouldn't be there. I cannot come up with that much. Neither can an independent agent, even one who is reasonably solvent. Now, if the state were to make the requirement, as they have on the surplus line broker, and say, you provide the state with a $200,000 bond, possibly he can do that. Now, if he can't do it, the question is, should he be in business? I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I think there's a point that has to be clarified here. Basically, what I hear Mr. Bitterbauer speaking to is dealings with the surplus line market. And there is a distinction between the surplus line market and the admitted market, that being that that surplus line market has not subjected itself to state regulation, which is why the $200,000 bond requirement exists on the surplus line broker.
Right.
The current level of bond on a broker is $10,000, and we talked about this in legislative hearings. We agreed that doesn't really provide the kind of protection that's needed anyway.
But the bond market is such that it's so onerous to require more than
If you provided what was necessary, you'd be talking substantial bonds that nobody would be able to buy, and your remote areas of the state probably wouldn't have direct insurance.
I remember we worked on that for a long time.
If I might interject there, Don, if they're too onerous, then it's impractical to say I can require it.
Well, except that, again, the point is not the dealing of a broker through an intermediary to an admitted company. It's dealing with a broker through an intermediary who happens to be a surplus line broker to a non-admitted company, to a surplus line company. And there is a different, the statutes place a different responsibility on those two different kinds of relationships.
let me throw out an alternate proposal of attacking the same thing that will make them happy and make a lot of people really unhappy. You don't know whether your guy is an agent or a broker, but if there were a clear disclosure, you walk in, he says, I am a broker. You give me the money and I steal it, you're SOL.
The personal lines of insurance. What we're talking about has involvement with large sums of money, premiums of upwards of $100,000. That is not going to... All right, what we could do, we could come out and say, all right, fine, you must pay directly to us, you cannot pay to the broker. If you're going to premium finance it, you must name us as the payee on the premium finance agreement, and the dollars must come directly to us. That's possible. What is going to happen? Because we've researched the question, we called some people out of state who do business up here. We said, House Bill 46 is now a reality. What are you going to do? What change is it going to make in your operation? And they said, absolutely none. We will roll the dice. If they are willing to roll the dice, if we wish to stay in business, it forces us into the same position. Because there is not a company that I can place coverage in that cannot be accessed through another surplus lines broker in Washington or Oregon or in some other state.
Chuck, have you ever written a policy, the same policy, where you're both an agent and a broker? We have two companies subscribing at 50%, and you're representing the company for half of the policy and the insured for the other half. Now, I've seen that happen.
You want to talk about
delusions of what the real responsibility is. And the other way to attack it is just say, okay, guys, you can't be both at once. You've got to be one or the other. And you have to clearly state it, and you have to show people what your responsibilities are. And I think you get the consumer protection that way. You say, don't buy from this guy, buy from that guy. But other than that, I think that if you're going to protect the customer, if you want to throw the customer out there and he pays his money and hopes he gets some insurance, that's where we were.
Mr. Bevier pointed out that we're not really talking about personal lines, personal insurance. We're talking about these commercial risks where you're paying anywhere from $2,000 to $200,000 a year or even more. And these are sophisticated buyers, most of them.
They
know what's going on.
Peter, I disagree 100% that these are sophisticated buyers. These are guys who are buying homeowners policies and also have a dump truck. Or they have a hardware store, but they aren't risk managers, they haven't had formal insurance training. They don't know whether
they know what they're doing.
Why did
all these truckers 2 years ago go out to a plumber and buy a post office box so they could get Territory 3 rates on dump trucks when they're operating in Anchorage? They know what they're doing.
Okay. I'm going to suggest that this seems like a subject that we ought to get into deeper and probably in a more informal setting where we can sit around a table and talk about solutions to the problem. But one thing I want the people who are in the managing general agents classification to remember is the legislature is seriously trying to protect our consumers. And that's probably where the bottom line is going to be. So if you can come up with suggestions to maintain that consumer protection, but to not put the burden on your particular firms, they will be entertained. It was never the goal of the legislature to put a class of people out of business here. We were trying to protect the consumers, put the burden on the insurers where we felt it belonged at that point, because we felt that they were authorizing these people to accept the money for them. It was their responsibility if these people took off with the money.
I would enjoy being in on an informal discussion on this.
Good.
The only point I would make there in closing,
and I'd really like to remind you that we had a dozen hearings on House Bill 46 last year, and nobody ever raised this issue. So don't think we were out to get you or anything, because we had, in Labor and Commerce alone, we had at least four hearings on it. I think in some of those days we spent 4 hours in there going over it line by line, and it never came up as a problem. So nobody was out to get you, just nobody ever said anything about it.
In closing, the only thing I would say is that it will create, if we were to go to the insurers and say, you must take this responsibility off of our shoulders, if we could somehow force that, you will only force that company out of the state. I don't know of a single company who would be impacted
on a non-admitted carrier, if they are writing $1 million to $2 million from the state, that's probably a lot of premium. And if you're taking a look at a company that's writing $100 million this year,
well,
nationwide.
Are they all these companies do business through managing general agents? I mean, none of them do directly with the...
The non-admitted carriers can only do business with someone holding a surplus line broker's license. They cannot go directly to a broker unless he holds a surplus line broker's license. And because of the stringent requirements of getting that license, most of your retail brokers have given up their surplus line broker's license.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sir, did you want to testify? You had your hand up.
I think now that you're talking about a separate discussion, I think I'd rather sit in on that. I don't think I have much to add.
Okay. Are there any further members of the public who'd like to testify at this time? All right. I think we should take a break because we've got to come back at 1:30. We've got a lot more to deal with on House Bill 46. We may have to schedule something before the session because we should do it here in Anchorage where people are. We can come and talk to us and see what we need to do to clean up what we did last year. I'd like to start out the workers' comp with you all talking about I've got some questions to deal with the overall comp rates situation. And then we'll try to take a presentation from the ad hoc committee and hope they're ready to give us their bottom line now. Does that sound okay?
We'll be here.
Okay, we'll be back at 1:30.